This is KSQD Santa Cruz, KSQT Prunedale, KSQD 89.5, 89.7, 90.7 FM, or online at ksqd.org. From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me. For 30 years, Johnny Carson hosted The Tonight Show on NBC, and he remains today considered to be the best ever host of a late-night talk show. Although off-camera, he remained an intensely private enigma. My guest today is comedian and writer Mark Malkoff. After concluding hundreds of interviews with Carson's friends, staff, and guests for his acclaimed Carson podcast, Mark Malkoff has distilled those stories into a revealing new book, Love Johnny Carson. It offers a rare, intimate look at the genius, the grueling production, the man behind the Tonight Show desk. Mark Malkoff, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Gary, thanks for having me.
I was a big fan of the Tonight Show and of Johnny, and I think he's the best there ever was.
Agreed.
Yeah. I remember with the show when it was 90 minutes and it was on in New York. And one of the things about the Tonight Show that I think people maybe don't remember is that at the last half hour of that 90-minute show, they would have a guest that had written a book or something, and Johnny would have a very erudite conversation, uninterrupted. You know, nowadays the Tonight Show is like 5-minute segments with all jokes and Jimmy Fallon trying to get his joke in. You know, but Carson didn't do that. He let the people talk.
That's true. I mean, he would have a pre-interview in front of him, but a lot of times he would just throw it out and have an organic conversation. I mean, there were people that went in with unknown books and he would make them bestsellers. I mean, it was the last half hour. When he started, it was an hour and 45 minutes, and then it went down to 90 minutes. And Carson wanted to pick up the pace in around 1980, and they made it an hour. And all the authors were gone by then, unfortunately. But I mean, he had some really interesting people that last half hour. People you wouldn't think of, like the head of the NRA, head of the Church of Satan, people like with drug reform. Like people don't really give Carson a credit. More back in New York for having people that were somewhat controversial, like the famous atheist Madeline Murray O'Hare. So he was putting people on that they would get complaints, but he felt it was important to put people on with different points of view.
Now, Mark Malkoff, I'm looking at you. We're looking at each other on the Zoom here, listeners. And unless you're using some unusual filter, you look to me to be a fairly young man. And so I'm wondering, do you remember firsthand the Carson Show?
Oh, you are so nice to say that. I remember my dad letting me stay up sometimes on Fridays or during the summer and watching Carson, and he would do primetime anniversary shows, and I would videotape. I would have it on VHS, tape it, and watch it over and over again. It would be my introduction to show business because he's with all these A-list comedians and actors, and then he's with kids, he's with animals, he's doing sketches. Yeah, it was an amazing learning experience. My dad was getting me into Stanley Kramer's It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. So, you know, I'm on the playground talking about Buddy Hackett and Jerry Lewis, and the kids are talking about Mickey Mouse. So it was just this different world that I was in, and I was very happy to be there.
So you started a podcast a few years ago after having seen, I think you said in your book, you watched the PBS American Masters special about Carson, and it sort of inspired you. Tell us a little bit about your podcast.
I always was a big Johnny Carson fan. And for someone that dominated American culture for 30 years and was that powerful, there weren't that many stories about what went on behind the scenes and really how Johnny put the show together. So Peter Jones in 2012 did an American Masters PBS special with Johnny Carson, which I loved. But I had even more questions. I sat down with Peter in Beverly Hills and I said, I have this idea to do this Johnny Carson podcast. And Peter told me, Mark, you have to do this. Tell everyone I endorse you. I called Peter the next day and I say, who do you think I should have on the podcast? He said, do you want Carl Reiner's home phone number? I said, yes. Do you want Doc Severinsen's cell phone number? Uh-huh. How about Angie Dickinson's email address? So the seas parted right away. And before I knew it, I was in Carl Reiner's Beverly Hills home. We couldn't really do Zooms like this. So I'm with Carl Reiner, and then he tells his best friend, Mel Brooks, you got to talk to the kid. So the next day, I'm in Culver City at Mel Brooks's office, and Mel's telling me about going on the very first show, October 1st, 1962. So I had no idea when I picked Carson as a subject that all these people would want to share their stories. I really do equate it like somebody loved their college experience. It was one of the best times of their life, but they never really have the chance to talk about it in detail with somebody that really cares and that's knowledgeable. So a lot of these people would thank me afterwards, and I'm like, you're thanking me? This is amazing. So I talked to over 400 people for the podcast and then for the book about Carson, going on the show knowing Carson.
Well, a few years ago I had a guest here on From the Bookshelf named Henry Bushkin, known as the Bombastic Bushkin by Johnny. And he wrote a book. He was a good friend of Carson's for a while, but then wasn't a good friend anymore. The Carson really had closed the door to him. And his book characterizes Carson as a narcissist, and he actually goes into some research about narcissism. Did you ever talk with Bushkin, and do you have any take on what Bushkin's analysis was on?
I never talked to him. The people I talked to that knew Johnny Carson said he was not a narcissist at all. A lot of them didn't think Bushkin's book was accurate throughout several places. I don't know. It's interesting because, like, I believed Joan Rivers, and I believed somewhat Henry Bushkin's book, that Johnny really didn't have friends. And then I'm talking to the friends that spent time with him that were like, Mark, no, he was the best friend. He was almost the same Johnny on and off the Tonight Show, which I couldn't believe. I mean, this was consistent with the people that loved him, that knew him. And I couldn't believe that, to get that assessment from the others. I mean, Henry Bushkin said Johnny Carson died alone and tried to make it out that he didn't really have close relationships. When Johnny died, his wife Alex was there, his two surviving sons, and other people that were close to him. So it really seemed to me that Mr. Bushkin was trying to make this out, that Johnny didn't have friends, didn't have people that loved him. And that, from talking to these people, was simply not the case. And I was really shocked to talk to these people. I mean, Johnny, when he was overseas with Wimbledon, he'd be with Roger Moore in France. He'd be in the Bronx here in New York with George C. Scott having lunch. He had two poker games where he was with all these friends. Like, I talked to Barry Diller and Chevy Chase that were part of the poker game. So it was this whole different Johnny, and I was shocked that the media, who made this guy out to be cold and aloof, really got it completely wrong. Yes, he was shy. Yes, he liked his alone time, but I mean, he, just for self-preservation reasons, people that knew him said that he really couldn't be Johnny Carson all the time, just because he couldn't walk down the street without people coming up to him. I mean, he tried to live as normal life as he could for being maybe the most famous man in America, but it was challenging.
What about Joan Rivers, for instance? I mean, she was, for those who don't remember, she was a frequent guest host.
Yeah.
And then she got the opportunity to have her own show. Fox Network was just getting started, and she was like the anchor for that new network. And Carson did not give her a break about it. He was very unhappy that she had done it.
We go into this. I mean, she always gave Johnny attribution for her career. In 1965, Miss Rivers goes on Carson's show. Suddenly, the press is heralding her as the next Carol Burnett, Walter Winchell. Everybody's singing her praises. And then in 1982, I believe it was 82, Johnny Carson, for the very first time, has a permanent guest host for when he's not there. And he picks Joan Rivers. Suddenly, she breaks Sinatra's I think it was in Vegas or it was in Atlantic City. It was some for residency. She breaks his how much money you're being paid. I mean, being the permanent guest host just opened up so much more opportunities for Miss Rivers. And then at some point, they had her and her husband, Edgar Rosenberg, had their lawyers go to Fox to see if they'd possibly be interested in Miss Rivers. And they absolutely were. I sat down with Barry Diller, who was the head of Fox here in New York. And Barry Diller told me that he told Joan, you have an obligation to tell Johnny, you need to. I'm friends with Johnny. I'm in a poker game with him. You need to tell him. And Rivers' own friends were pleading with her. Sandy Gallen, her manager, ex-manager, like, Johnny's going to be so hurt. You need to tell him. He's going to be upset, and rightfully so. And her husband, Edgar, was the one that said, you cannot tell him, there's going to be unforeseen circumstances if you don't tell him. And then all weekend leading up to this, Johnny and Fred DeCordova, Johnny's producer, were trying to get Miss Rivers on the phone, and she wouldn't take their phone calls because they were hearing these rumors. And finally, Brandon Tartikoff, the head of NBC, said Joan did sign with Fox 2.5 months prior. So for 2.5 months, guest hosting The Tonight Show, negotiating to keep guest hosting The Tonight Show. Yeah, she had signed this deal with Fox. And not only that, Miss Rivers admits this, that her first phone call right after this was to Johnny's prize producer, Peter LaSalle, and she offered Peter double his salary to go to Fox. Every talent coordinator that Johnny had, all five were offered double their salary to go over with Miss Rivers. Johnny couldn't believe that she was trying to take his staff. It was way more complicated than just that Joan wasn't allowed to or didn't tell Johnny. And Johnny never mentioned her again on The Tonight Show. I mean, she didn't exist. I mean, he would get hurt very easily, his friend said. And he was just felt so betrayed that he just never mentioned her. Everyone else sat down with Johnny. Everyone from Cavett to Joey Bishop, they said, I have an opportunity to go up against you. And Carson, every single time, said, you have to take the money. You need to do it. Their shows would inevitably fail, and then they'd go back on with Johnny. Johnny's own cue card person went up to Johnny and said, I have the opportunity in my company to do cue cards for Joan Rivers' show at Fox. And Johnny said, you have to do it. It's business. I totally understand. Do it. And Johnny's cue card person said, I won't be there, but my company. And Johnny said, please take it. It was just all about sitting down and doing it the right way. And Miss Rivers, I think she was trying to be a good wife, and unfortunately it ruined their relationship. 10 months after into Fox, her talk show, Barry Diller said, your husband is being removed as producer or else you're not going to be host anymore. She thought Diller was bluffing. Diller wasn't, and her tenure then was over at Fox. 2 months later, unfortunately, Mr. Edgar Rosenberg took his own life. And Joan had never been lower in her life. She found out, she said that she was millions of dollars in debt. She found out that she was in debt. And talk about resiliency and reinventing yourself. I mean, such an amazing icon, pioneer of comedy. And I give her so much credit for rebuilding her life. But I do not think she ever got over that that incident with Johnny. And Johnny never spoke with her again.
We're talking with Mark Malkoff, and he's just written a book about Johnny Carson. And it's a good book, and there's a lot of interviews that you've conducted, 400 interviews, yeah. You said. So was there a specific story or revelation from a guest or a staffer that completely changed your perspective on Carson?
The media made him out to be this recluse guy who was not social. And I'm talking to Diane Cannon, who went on the show a lot, dated Carson. And she said, Mark, no, Johnny would be at parties at my house. He'd bring his drums. He'd be playing on the drums. Dudley Moore would be playing on the piano. Johnny would be making popcorn for everyone. It was this completely different Carson that I was talking to. I mean, it was those are the people that I talked to, the people that were friends with him that for years were just so loyal to him. And they said that there was never a better friend than him. So I think just a lot of those stories just really did shock me. And people all over the country that missed Johnny were listening to this podcast for 8 years, just with all these stories. I mean, he was giving – I couldn't believe talking to the comedians that would say that Johnny would give them punch-ups to their material, their suggestions on how to get bigger laughs. And for a young comic, it was like Christmas morning to get these from Carson. So it was definitely from talking to these people a different Johnny than was ever portrayed by the other books, I would say.
The thing about Carson is he could really boost someone's career. In the book you talk about Bette Midler, but I remember Cindy Lauper's career really being boosted in 1981, I think it was. Having her on a number of times and giving her a showcase.
Jimmy Buffett, too. Jimmy Buffett said, Mark, it was the biggest break in my career going in 1981. I couldn't get booked on television until Johnny Carson. He said that was the biggest break of his career, that and opening up for the Eagles. And he said, Mark, you're the first person in my entire career to ask me about Johnny Carson. That is why I'm talking to you. I do want to mention, I did try to talk to Miss Rivers for my podcast. She wouldn't talk to me. I tried to talk to Melissa Rivers. I tried to talk to Wayne Newton. There were only a handful of people that had problems with him, but I wasn't able to get those people, unfortunately. But I really did want to get them on to get their version and talk to them.
I'm sure he was already had left the planet by the time you were doing your podcast, but also Carl Sagan was one of his friends who he had a falling out with.
I would have loved it. You know, they were still on good terms, but he would not have Carl Sagan back on the Tonight Show because tonight after, I think it might have been, I don't know, a dozen times, maybe 18 times, Sagan interrupted Johnny twice during a guest appearance to correct him on statistics. And the way that he did it, Johnny did not feel was good manners. And I think he was just embarrassed and he refused to ever book Sagan on again, which is really unfortunate. You know, he would go out to dinner with certain people after the show, always Carl Sagan, Jim Fowler, who would bring on the animals, Dr. Paul Ehrlich, who was a population control advocate. It was unfortunate that there were certain people. The manners were very important to Johnny, which is ironic because he would talk on the Tonight Show when he would drink. He would say he would get really, really bad and you didn't want to be around him. So his manners then would be atrocious. But on the Tonight Show, if anybody was rude, like Jerry Lewis was rude to Johnny's staff, Jerry Lewis was banned from the show. Any bad manners, you were done on the show, behind the scenes, or on camera. And unfortunately, that's what happened to Mr. Sagan in Johnny's, at least in Johnny's mind.
Oh, right. At least in Johnny's mind.
Yeah.
What did Jerry Lewis do? Do you know?
Jerry Lewis allegedly was not nice to one of the cue card people and was rude and yelled at him. And Johnny said that he's never going to be on again. There was a famous comedian that said something very inappropriate to one of Carson's secretaries, somebody at the show, a very famous person. I can tell you who it is afterwards. And he said the person will never be on the show again. And they weren't. I mean, it was just somebody like William Shatner, his third time on Carson. He did a few things. One, he wouldn't let Johnny get a word in for like 2 or 3 minutes. And he was being boring. He was just going on, and Johnny couldn't get a word in. He thought that was bad manners. And then Shatner turns his back to Johnny, I think to talk to the previous guest, who was Buddy Hackett, and Carson didn't like when a guest that was supposed to be there would turn his back to him. And then the third thing is back then you weren't allowed to say what network you were on unless it was NBC. They'd say, watch Saturday's TJ Hooker on another network.
Right.
And of course, Shatner said, watch me on ABC on Saturdays. And they had to beat. They had to beep ABC. So it was like basically 3 strikes and you're out. If he did perceive bad manners, it was over.
You know, I know that a lot of the Tonight shows from the New York years especially were erased.
That's right.
Which is like a tragedy. But I wonder, was that difficult, you know, when you're trying to track down or either prove or debunk something?
It was. I mean, I did a lot of research. I mean, I talked to as many people as I could that were there for the New York years. And I just went through a lot of newspapers and a lot of things like Variety just to see what was going on with the New Yorkers. It was a bit of a puzzle putting those things together. Jenny went through a lot of producers. They had so many interesting guest hosts. And it was a little bit of, I felt like almost a private investigator detective putting those pieces together.
So you said you went to the home. I'm very jealous. You went to Carl Reiner's and Mel Brooks's homes. What other interviews are you most, you know, like thrilled that you got that opportunity?
I mean, in terms of homes, because back then I couldn't do anything remotely on Zoom. Paul Anka had me into his home. I went to Mel's office at Culver City, which he's been there forever. Angie Dickinson's home in Beverly Hills. I mean, it was, I couldn't believe that this was happening. In New York, I'd go to people's apartments or offices. I would always say I'm happy to go to you or we can do it nearby. So there was definitely something intimate about being with them. And also, I am so bad with tech. I didn't know how to set up 2 microphones. So I have 1 microphone I'm holding and going back and forth. So the person is sitting pretty much near me. And I think that these people could tell I had absolutely no agenda to do gotcha journalism. Not that I'm a journalist. And I just really wanted to get these stories. And I did so much research, as much research as I could. And I think that really got people to open up. And I'm grateful that they did. But yeah, it was a lot of pinch me moments when I would be sitting down with some of these people. You mentioned Florence Henderson. We had a lunch in Marina Del Rey. And, you know, like you, Brady Bunch, grew up on Florence Henderson. And just to be there having a lunch with her while we recorded was so special.
She was a wonderful person.
Agreed.
Very much. When Carson got on the air in 1962 with The Tonight Show, there had already been the Steve Allen version of The Tonight Show and, of course, the Jack Parr version. And Carson took a lot of the things from them. I mean, the idea of doing a monologue and then sitting down and doing a comedy bit and having the microphone on the desk and all those things. Mm-hmm. But also some of his most iconic features, you can, if you see those old Steve Allen shows, you can see a lot of those same bits. Do you think Carson borrowed liberally from those guys?
There's definitely people that, and I go about this in the book, I talk about this, that a lot of people thought that Johnny Carson ripped off Carnac the Magnificent from Steve Allen, who did a very similar routine. But I go back into the history. There, the bit originated in Collier's Magazine in the 40s with this gentleman named Carl Winston. Carl Winston and Johnny both said the same thing, which is Johnny in 1948 bought for $200 the right to do this bit, and Johnny owned it. Now, he was doing it locally in Los Angeles, not around the country. So when Steve Allen took over The Tonight Show and was doing a very similar bit, even though Johnny technically owned it, everybody thought that Steve Allen was the guy that did this. And he wrote a book with the bit. And Carl Winston said, this guy is ripped me off and didn't pay me anything. And that was consistent. Now, there was another person, character that Johnny did that a lot of people thought was Jonathan Winters. And I think that one was taken from Jonathan Winters. Winters was asked if Aunt Blabby, if that bothered him that he was basically doing Maud Frickett. And he said no, because Johnny doesn't do it that well. and then you have Reginald Van Gleason, which was very similar to Art Fearn. But yes, in the beginning, for the first 7 years, he was not doing the Gleason voice at all. It was, the original character was Bernie Schlock. Didn't have the mustache, had the wig, and it evolved, and then he did start taking the Reginald Van Gleason. I mean, Carson would deny all of this. He would say that he did the Aunt Blabby character back in the early 50s. He was doing an elderly lady, but I think it morphed into the Jonathan Winters routine bit that we all loved.
Well, of course, a lot of those comedy bits go back to burlesque and vaudeville. I mean,
that's what Johnny said. Johnny said that originally that there was a very similar thing to Carnac that they would do in vaudeville, and that Allen had zero invention. Steve Allen said two of his writers came up with it. So there was definitely a lot of debate here and there. But I mean, David Letterman gave Steve Allen complete attribution for doing the stunts, and Letterman would publicly said, you know, yeah, we're doing Steve Allen. Jack Parr was all about controversy, and Johnny said, I'm going to do an entertainment show. And he just wanted to put his own mark on that show. And he really did. I mean, he turned down the gig because everybody was telling him nobody can replace Jack Parr. But it was Johnny's wife, wife number two, was his girlfriend at the time, that talked him into it and set everything up in motion for that. But it was for a solid year. The media and speculation was Merv Griffin was going to replace Johnny. I mean, it took him a while. This was a game show host. That is how the public viewed him. He was an ABC game show host. What business does he have hosting a late night show, especially replacing our beloved Jack Parr? When Bill Murray replaced Chevy Chase on Saturday Night Live, oh my goodness, the mail that came in for Bill Murray, how dare you replace Chevy Chase. I mean, it really does take the public a little bit of time to adapt and get used to the person. And there definitely took a little bit of time with Johnny.
Pete Best Forever, Ringo Never.
Oh my goodness. Isn't that? Yeah. I mean, it really does take a while. Once they see you as something, it's so interesting to me. Like Mike Wallace started like doing his game shows and doing all this journalism. And then he makes the switch to 60 Minutes. So yeah, it was interesting to see Barbara Walters. You know, she's singing on The Tonight Show as a guest host, and then she became something else. Same with Hugh Downs, Jack Parr's sidekick, and then suddenly he's doing Hard News. So it really does take the public perception a little time, it seems, to when they pivot to do something else.
We are talking with Mark Malkoff, and he has a new book. It's called Love, Johnny Carson, and it's about Johnny Carson. David Letterman, he was kind of the anointed successor to Carson, although he didn't end up getting The Tonight Show. But Carson was on his show, not on Leno's show.
Yeah, Johnny, his last public appearance, it was almost 2 years from the time that he left The Tonight Show. And Dave Letterman was doing a month, or was doing a week rather, at CBS Television City, CBS, and Dave, had Johnny do a cameo, and it was so deafening with the applause that Johnny was gonna say something, but he couldn't get the words out because it was thunderous. Johnny impromptu asked Dave if he could sit down at the desk, and it was just so emotional. Letterman later said it was the best day of his entire life to have Carson on his show, and Johnny wanted Dave to be the replacement of him. But you know, NBC never asked Johnny, and it went to Leno. You know, Jay went to all the NBC affiliates and was politicking for the job, where Dave would call the NBC affiliates pinheads, make fun of GE, which owned NBC. And it was just a matter of who's going to be easier to control. And it was Jay Leno. So yeah, Johnny was sad about that, but you know, they both had shows with longevity and it all worked out. Yeah. You know, Letterman really, and Johnny, they really did love each other. Johnny had Dave, after like four appearances, guest host the show as an unknown. The first person that was an unknown that ever guest hosted The Tonight Show. Him and Gary Shandling were the only two people that were complete unknowns. And then famously in 1982, Johnny produced Dave Letterman's show, which followed his and gave him his own show in February of 1982, right after Johnny's time slot. So there was a lot of love there.
Well, Johnny Carson was not an old man when he stopped doing The Tonight Show. And I think people thought, well, he'll do something else. He'll do specials. Yeah. He'll do film. He'll do something. But he ended up never doing anything. Why did he not do anything?
He was 66 when he left. He had an office in Santa Monica and would take pitches and think about things. I think it's twofold. One is definitely he did not want to be perceived as Bob Hope, who we thought stuck around way too long. He thought the quality of Hope's performance went way down, and he didn't want to be perceived. You know, Dana Carvey was doing these Saturday Night Live sketches penned by Robert Smigel, portraying Carson as senile and out of touch, and Johnny just didn't really want to be perceived like that. He thought it was a mistake that Lucille Ball came back and was doing television when she shouldn't be. Thought Frank Sinatra, when he was bumbling, lyrics left and right. Johnny went to see him, I think, in the early 90s, and he's like, why is Frank doing this to himself? So I think that was one of the reasons he never came back. I think the second one is that he gave up smoking. He was smoking two packs of Pall Malls unfiltered, like the worst kind of cigarette that you could do. Since he was 14, he was a chain smoker. His dad, Homer, was a smoker. And Johnny put on some weight. I think part of the reason he never really came back was cosmetic as well, because he put on some pounds. But, you know, we all wanted him to come back, and I think it would have been amazing. He almost did come back to do a special that his two prized writers, Mike Barry and Jim Mulholland, wrote. It was a really funny special. It's available online somewhere, the script. But, yeah, Johnny, at the end of the day, said, you know what, I did it for 30 years. Let the work speak for itself, and we never saw him again.
Well, I'm very glad that you wrote this book. I really enjoyed reading it, and I've definitely enjoyed talking to you. The book is called Love, Johnny Carson, and the author, Mark Malkoff. Mark, thank you so much for coming here and talking to us.
This was really nice to talk to you. I'm grateful, and we do talk about Carson's faults in the book, too. It's called Love, Johnny Carson, but the guy was far from perfect, and I do want to make that clear, and we go into that. But in terms of a definitive Tonight Show book from 1962 to 92 and Carson's retirement years, I feel very fortunate that we covered it in the best length, the most detail, and people like Dick Cavett and all these people just really have been praising the book, and it means the world to me. So Gary, thank you so much for having me. This was fun.
My guest is Todd Diamond. His new book is called Pass the Trauma, Please. And it is that most unusual book. It is a funny Holocaust memoir. I think it's probably the only funny Holocaust memoir ever written. Todd Diamond, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks, Gary. Good to be.
Did you get any resistance when you presented this? I mean, it's not the kind of story that usually goes along with humor.
Yeah. My father had a lot to do with that. When I presented an early draft to him, he rejected it and said, "Who is this? I don't recognize this guy. I don't recognize your voice. Where are the F-bombs?" There's no language here. There's no drinking. There's no sex. So go back and try again. So yeah, that the humor I have to blame on my father comes directly from him. And early on, he gave me a non-negotiable editorial note. And it's probably best if I read an excerpt from it so I get it right.
Absolutely.
Let's see. It starts by saying, "From me, I'm a slow writer in a race against the inevitable date of my father's death. He's one of the last remaining Holocaust survivors. He's 93 years old as I write this. He's healthy. He's wise. He insisted I tell the world that he still gets it up with a little boost from Viagra. My father knows I'm attempting to write his story. He did have one request. He said, please, just not another Holocaust memoir with the long-winded descriptions and elaborate accounts of the smells in the ghetto, the corpses. Everyone knows this already. Elie Wiesel, Primo Levi, Anne Frank, the guy who wrote the comic book about the mass, they all covered it. Spielberg, too. Such a genius. So do something different. Don't be afraid to slip in a few jokes. What do you call it again? That bullshit you always say? Oh, yeah. Write something poster-punk? He meant to say post-punk. My father concluded his appeal by saying, and besides, you're no Elie Wiesel.
So it was his command that you...
It was his command. And, you know, as he said, he wanted people to cry while reading his book, but he also felt it was important to make them laugh. And that was a real challenge, to balance the reverence with irreverence. So regarding the humor in the book, it works almost like a Trojan horse. It's a way to smuggle in some hard truths about genocide and atrocity. And then sometimes there's this trap door under the punchlines where, you know, you go from laughter, you know, you're sucked down into sadness, often in the same sentence. And again, I have to give my dad the credit here because he understood that for a second generation Holocaust story to kind of break through today, it had to bust some of the genre's conventions. But we had to do it in ways that didn't diminish the seriousness or feel disrespectful. And then back to your earlier point, I do realize that some readers are going to find the humor in a Holocaust memoir could be glib or offensive. And I don't think that's great. It's not ideal, but I'd rather be brutally honest than shield readers with a more traditional comforting narrative or structure.
Well, it's a very enjoyable read, which isn't something you can say about Holocaust memoirs in general. And was your father happy with the final version?
Oh, he was delighted. He's read it 3 times. And I think probably one of the greatest moments in my entire life and was when I finished the book and I was finally able to place it into his hands while he's still here. That's a moment I'll never forget.
And how is he?
He's ornery. Okay. He's 95. He just turned 95 in December. And his health is pretty good. He's slowing down a little bit, but he still has his sense of humor. He's still wildly inappropriate. He has a girlfriend who's quite a bit younger than him. He has very strong opinions and that he doesn't, you know, hold back, which was really great for the writing process, even though it came, you know, I discovered so much late in life.
I'm sorry to hear that he has a girlfriend because I was hoping to fix him up with my mom. She's 94.
Oh, yeah.
But he likes younger women.
Yeah. How old is your mom?
94.
Oh, nice. Yeah. God bless him.
Yeah.
God bless him.
So, there's a lot of you in the book too. It's not just about your father's experiences, and you talk, and I can identify with the music that you love. You talk about Dylan and Bowie and those things helping to get you through your traumas, which are considerable, but nothing like the traumas that your father went through. Did your father have a similar kind of, did he have a musical crutch? Did he like, is that part of what his cultural feelings about things? Did he use music at all?
To a certain degree, he did use music. There was a lot of, the Barry sisters and Connie Francis. Herb Alpert was a major.
Oh, yeah. You mentioned Whipped Cream and Other Delights, an album.
Yeah, Whipped Cream and Other Delights.
I had a love affair with that album cover for several years.
But. Yeah. Same here. And that is the album that was playing the day I first learned about my father's Holocaust story. You know, the needle came off, and then he started, talking a little bit more about it.
So you didn't really, it wasn't something that you talked about from the time you could earliest remember. There's a moment where it was uncovered for you. You didn't know that he was a Holocaust survivor before that?
No. And I think one thing that I learned was that survivors, they make this kind of silent deal with themselves. You survive, you don't share, you build a new life, and you protect your children from the worst of it. My father was simply trying to shield us. But the silence had consequences too, because, the first time, as I said, I learned any pieces of his story, I was 19, just back from college, and the reaction to that kind of suppression sent me into pure rage. And I write in the book that I actually applied to work for the Simon Wiesenthal Center. I was going to dedicate my life to becoming a Nazi hunter. And I wrote a really long, impassioned letter of why I was the right person to help them hunt down the worst criminals against humanity. And they rejected me. They sensed way too many anger issues that I needed to work out. And they weren't looking to recruit for the Inglorious Bastards division. something just happened to my dad in his 90s. I think he realized that if he didn't start to tell these stories now, that they would just disappear with him.
Right. I mean, that's one of the things, right, that Holocaust survivors, I mean, I was raised, I was born only 10 years after World War II, and, never forget, always remember. That's one of the things that we were raised with. And is that part of your motivation in writing past the trauma?
Well, that and, Jewish guilt is very persuasive. There's just so many times you can hear your father say, "Hey, Putz, when are you going to write my Holocaust story? I'm not getting any young over here." So, there was that and also this real sense of obligation because, our generation, we could be the last ones with direct access to Holocaust survivors. And if their stories aren't captured now, they could disappear. They can get distorted. And then there was that urgency. I really wanted to get my dad's details while he's alive and he could still correct the record. As I discovered, if you can get enough scotch into him, he might reveal things that he had kept hidden for like 70 years, which he did over Chinese food.
Yes. Yeah. You have a sort of, we're talking with Todd Diamond. He's written an interesting Holocaust memoir called Past the Trauma. You have this sort of framing device where you're in a Chinese restaurant in California, And but I want to know, did you record your interviews with your father, or were they just simply done in Chinese restaurants?
Well, it was a very specific dinner where it all came out. So I like to say, you know, it's kind of, you know, the Holocaust memoir that begins in a Chinese restaurant. Yeah. When my dad is 93 and we're sitting in a red vinyl booth. You know, the Lazy Susan is there. It's covered in dumplings and, you know, other assorted fried stuff. And my dad, glass of scotch in his hand as always. And then suddenly he just starts telling me things about the Holocaust that he had never told anyone before. And that's when I realized this wasn't just another dinner conversation, that this might be, you know, the last chance I have to accurately capture his history. So on one level, it's my father's Holocaust story, but it's not just about him. It turned into a father-son Holocaust memoir. And in many ways, the book became a collaboration between us. And it's also about how trauma moves into the next generation. And in our case, you know, humor becomes one of the only ways to survive such, you know, terrible memories. And Gary, you know, of course, the book doesn't avoid the horrors. There's plenty of it in there. I mean, it is a Holocaust memoir.
Sure.
So, if you give me a little room here, you know, and I'll apologize in advance to your audience because I'm about to sorrow bomb them. With a highlight reel, that's okay.
That's fine.
All right. So here comes the dark stuff. And I try to recite this to myself a lot. So my father's parents were murdered by the Nazis. His father died in the Treblinka death camp. His mother was shot to death in a hospital by German soldiers, very similar to the scene in Schindler's List. At 12 years old, my father gets arrested by the Gestapo for smuggling medicine into the Warsaw ghetto so that his father, a physician, could continue treating patients. My father survived because he had false identity papers that were provided by a Polish police captain. And after that, he was sent to Germany as a slave laborer, where he was brutally abused for more than 2 years. But there was an upside to being on the farm, which I won't give away. Farmer's daughter.
Yeah.
Eventually he escapes and he makes his way back to Warsaw, and he was put on top of a train, which is kind of like a Tom Cruise Mission Impossible stuff. And when he arrives in Warsaw, the city is just obliterated and his family is wiped out. And then his life takes some interesting turns. Back in Poland, he's recruited by Zionists because, you know, orphans make very fierce soldiers. He's trained by the Haganah, and he fights in the war for Israeli independence. And then after that, things lighten up just a bit. He ends up in New York City. He opens a pharmacy with a $50,000 loan from a madam who ran the brothel next door. Yeah. Which is a lot of money in the 70s.
Yeah.
He meets my mother, not in the brothel, but at a dance in Brooklyn. They marry, they have two sons, and decades later, he's in his 90s, and he starts revealing all kinds of stuff to me, long buried stuff, in, of course, a Chinese restaurant. And I've just came to the realization that Catholics have confessional booths, and Jews have Chinese restaurant booths.
Yes, I wonder if in China, Chinese families gather around in a deli and have lox.
Corned beef. It's a powerful truth serum.
Well, do you feel that this book has a certain resonance in our current situation? There's a sort of a rise in global anti-Semitism.
Yeah, and it gets pretty heavy for my dad because, you know, he was a soldier. Well, in 1948, he fought And he arrived in Palestine 1945, and he was there from 1945 to 1950. And being trained by the Haganah, you do some things. Some morally questionable things, but it's all in the name of building a Jewish state, especially after the Holocaust. It was, you know, a holy mission for him and many other orphans that he came over on a boat with, 700 orphans, I believe there was. And my father was a wreck when he got to Palestine. And there was a teacher, his name is Matityahu, who's a famous folk singer as well. And he rehabilitated my dad and helped him from taking his own life. At one point, my dad was so distraught because his best friend in the whole world was assassinated next to him. And he saved my father's life, pushed my father out of the way. And took the bullet himself.
Wow.
So my dad has a very deep connection to Israel. So his perspective is definitely shaped by that experience. And in the book, we have a chapter where we debate Israel and Palestine across the dinner table, sometimes loudly. And what interested me wasn't just settling the politics, it was showing how families can navigate through extremely charged issues like the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But the shocking thing was that here I was writing about the Holocaust, thinking, you know, this will never happen again. And then as I'm writing about the Holocaust, the second largest number of Jews being murdered occurred on October 7th. So that reality came crashing in, and I had to shift the manuscript. Even though I was already done, I needed to include that moment because it did happen again. And anti-Semitism is on the rise globally, as well as anti-Semitism. As well as anti-Zionists. And, you know, I ran a couple of Facebook ads just to see how, you know, the book would do. I got hundreds of the most hateful things I've ever read that were anti-Semitic. I got death threats. My father received death threats. Hmm. In fact, I kept, there was one ad that had so many comments. My wife said, you know, you can videotape, you can video that and you can capture that. So I scrolled through it and the video is 1.5 minutes of just hate against Jews, against Israel. So, it's important to get the stories out there. And, you know, honestly, again, getting back to humor, you hope that by telling a story like this in a more humorous way, it opens up the audience. It humanizes the victims. They're not just black and white footage, you know, on the History Channel. They're real people. And, you know, maybe it's naive, but, you know, at some point I was hoping even the haters would read the book instead of just criticizing it and say, you know, them Jews, you know, they control the money, they control the media. But, you know, they ain't so bad. And I mean, that would have been a great reaction, from some of the haters and the trolls out there. And, I'd love to get the book into their hands at some point.
Well, my guest is Todd Diamond, and his book is called Past the Trauma, and it's well worth your time. And thank you for writing it.
Even though some things were really, really hard to write, like taking my father back to Treblinka, the site of his father's murder. I also got to write about resilience and the Treblinka uprising, which is a moment in history that's not really talked about, but I think it's a great example of the Jewish spirit, that Maccabee warrior spirit, about fighting back and not just walking into the gas and into the ovens. And resilience is something that my father, you know, has always instilled in us. And recently, when there's a moment that really illustrates resilience for my father, when he was 12, as I mentioned earlier, the Gestapo arrested him and his parents were murdered after that, which meant he was never able to have a bar mitzvah. 83 years later, he had one. And he did it for his grandchildren and for his sons. And I just want to say that he crushed his Haftorah portion.
Well, I hope you got him a nice fountain pen.
I was looking for a savings bond.
Todd Diamond, the book is called Past the Trauma. Todd, thank you so much for being with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Gary.
Now I want you to meet Allison Van Diggelen. As a roving reporter for the BBC and the host of the Fresh Dialogues podcast, she interviewed celebrities and influential figures like Meryl Streep and Richard Branson. But in her new book, The Love Project, A Journey of Intimate Conversations, she tells us stories of true love from everyday people from her community in Carmel by the Sea. Allison Van Diggelen, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me, Gary. It's a pleasure to join you.
So, it was your mother's romance that inspired your book?
That's right. My mother is now 93, and in her late 80s, she'd been a widow for over 20 years, and a man came into her life. And when I saw how it transformed her, I realized I had my focus. I had this lens of love. I'd always wanted to write a book, and finally I had the theme for my book, and that was love.
Well, you're very open in your book about a traumatic incident in Mexico and the anxiety that followed. So how did writing a book about intimate love stories, you know, help you navigate your own journey to healing?
Yes, it was. I feel my mother's story was a gift to me. And I realized when I saw that beautiful kindling of love in my mother's life, I saw the power of love. And as I say, I thought, here, finally, I've been wanting to write a book probably my whole life. And I thought, finally, I have this focus. And so I went looking for love stories in my community. Carmel, as you know, is one of the most romantic places in the world. And I thought there must be some really good love stories here. And in putting on my reporter's hat and interviewing my neighbors and random people I met in the street walking my dog in Carmel, I found these remarkable stories, and I got an education in not just what love is and what it's not, but I got a reminder of our common humanity. And in that journey of these intimate conversations with people, I just got filled up with hope and joy and love again. So I'm inviting readers with, you know, who will read The Love Project to come on that journey with me and really feel that power of love, because I feel we're in this world. There's so much hate in the world. There's so much polarization and war that I think right now we really need to be reminded of our common humanity. We're all in this together, and the power of love. In fact, I spoke at the at a local event here on Martin Luther King Day, and I quoted Martin Luther King, and I feel it's so apt and worth repeating, you know, till people tell me to shut up. And that is, Martin Luther King said, and I'm paraphrasing, but along the lines of, in our fight for justice, our greatest weapon is love. And that gives me added impetus to share this book with anyone who's at all interested in moving beyond this polarization, this divisiveness that we're in, and finding hope and joy again.
Well, in your book, Alison Van Diglin, The Love Project, you feature people from vastly different backgrounds, like a billionaire and a house cleaner and a hospice worker. So did you find a common thread in how they all experience and define love?
Yes, I'm glad you pointed out the diversity. I think for people that think they know Carmel, the diversity of people I found, not just socioeconomic, but culturally, ethnically, age-wise, I interviewed teenagers all the way through to 90-year-olds. And yes, there was a common thread of you are not alone in whatever you're going through. And again, this power of love and friendship. And I'd love to kind of share with your listeners this whole idea of love. And I think a lot of people may have been like me at the beginning of my love project, thinking love is only romantic love. And what I found in this journey of these intimate conversations is love is, there's so many types of love. There is romantic love, filial love, gay love, trans love. There's love of a place, love of music, love of dogs. And if we can focus on what we love, we can make this world much more harmonic, much more loving, and we'll be less divided. One of the stories is very timely about a liberal grandma called Chris, and she walks her dog every morning on Carmel Beach, and she has befriended someone, let's say, from the opposite side of the political spectrum. They're intimate friends because they both love dogs and love rescuing dogs. And I feel it's almost like a parable, that one story of the 30 stories is a parable for all of us to get out of our silos of them and us, and, you know, letting politics invade our space and just focus on what we have in common with family members that we might be estranged from or having a difficult time with right now. Just focus on what do we have in common when we got on better? What was it that united us?
So the things we love, it's not just our mates, but ice cream and stuff like that.
Yes, anything at all. Anything can unite us. And I've done a lot of events around this, Gary, and it's amazing what comes up. I've had a lot of men come to my events, which surprised me because I really thought this was a book about women, but I've been really surprised how it's resonating with men. I had a man come up to me at an event and say, oh, I've also had a lot of trauma. He was a reporter in Silicon Valley and covered the police beat, and he saw his share of gory stuff. And so that was the part that resonated with him, you know, the trauma and the healing from the trauma and how important it is to talk with other people. And then another man shared he finds this common humanity because he does marathons. You know, he's off to the Boston Marathon next month, and he finds that, you know, when the gun goes, he says he can be on the start line, and when the gun goes at the start of the race, he says, I could have a CEO next to me, I could have a house cleaner or the janitor on the other side of me, but in that moment we're all revved up, ready to run our 26 miles. And he feels this euphoria every time he does a marathon. And I love this whole idea. And I think a lot of us had it watching the Olympics, the Winter Olympics, because again, if we can just focus on what we love, whether it's sports or whatever it is, we can be reminded that we're in this together. We have more in common than what divides us. That's one of the messages of the book.
Well, it's wonderful to have such a positive book. The book, again, is called The Love Project, A Journey of Intimate Conversations, and the author, Alison Van Diglin. Thank you for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, Gary.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.